Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, a podcast for people working in the real world of IT. If you're a sysadmin working on a help desk, a network engineer, an IT consultant, a computer techie who wants to know more about servers, or even if you want to get a job in the IT field, this podcast is for you. Hi, I'm Al.
And I'm Andy.
And I'm Jerry.
And this is up to episode 49. Now, if you want to call Germany, 49 is your number. And also the HP49 is a Hewlett Packard calculator. I think it's quite an old one. Also the number 49 was referring to plutonium. During the Manhattan Project, it was referred to as 49. Now the number 4 was for the last digit of the 94, which is the atomic number of plutonium, and the 9 was for the last digit in the 239, which is the atomic weight of plutonium. And of course, that was the weapon grade fissile isotope that was used in the nuclear bombs. Other than that, I've got nothing else to say about 47. So, it's been a few weeks since the last episode, so what has everyone been up to since we were last on?
Work-wise, it's quite interesting as well. I'm currently rolling out helping out with one of our sister companies, rolling out a switch or a whole network replacement for a hospital. I think it's about 400 switches we've got to replace in a hospital in the UK, and basically we upgraded the core center switch, and then we're just rolling out all of the switches on the side of them, which is quite interesting. Basically we're building them in our office and then getting shipped up to site to be installed when they can. So these are the switch stacks, which are basically HP switches, ECs, well, they're actually Ariba, now they've been rebranded, and basically they can vary from one 48 port switches to 448 port switches all in one stack. So they've got like stacking cables in the back of them, which basically means that they act as one switch, so that if you wanted to reconfigure a port, like the first switch, if you had four in a stack, and you normally, like, if they weren't stacked, you'd have like the first switch would be ports 1 to 24, the second switch would be 1 to 24, and so on and so on. But this one, the first switch would be 1 to 24, and then the second switch would be 24 to 48, if you see what I mean, and it goes on. So we're basically getting them out of the boxes, building them all, and then firmware updating them, and then putting an IP build on them, which is basically what the IP address is and what VLANs, what ports should be on them. At the moment, that's quite a bit of a manual task. I was actually thinking of maybe actually writing a script to it, because what it is someone's written a Word document and then colour-coded it with a red and blue text. So if it's blue text, it means you have to modify it depending on how many switches in the stack. So if there's four switches in a stack, you have to modify it to say that there's a four switches in a stack. And then the red one is like what you have to justify for what the IP addressings are, like depending what the IP address is, what the VLAN name is, and what the switch name is. And so you get given a sheet with the IP address and the naming on it, then you have to go in and change the red stuff and the blue stuff. So what I actually did was actually in the first place, there's like eight builds it can be depending on what amount, what the strict configuration is. So I basically created eight separate documents for each of the switches. But the problem you've got is, if you've got an A build, which is basically one 25 port switch, you pick an A switch, or if it's like an E switch is like 3 48 ports, you'd pick that E, and you'd have to go in with the red text and change it. So still quite manual. So what I was thinking of doing is maybe if you could write some sort of script or something, because basically what happens is you basically put it into a Word document, but then you have to copy and paste that in from a Word document into a text document, because Word format some of the things. So like there's a couple of like double quotes in it, which like totally says like the VLAN name, like this is like VLAN, the voice VLAN or the VLAN back to the so and so. And in Word it puts like the little quotes, but they put it left and right, so like an opening bracket and a closing bracket, and when you paste that into the switch it doesn't like that, so you have to change them over to like two little just normal brackets, or like the two little, if you know what I mean, kind of thing.
Yeah.
So yeah, so then you can paste that into the switch and it will be fine. But it's just like trying to, if you've got 400 of these switches and then you've got like 150 stacks, you want to make it kind of streamlined. So I'm making it more and more streamlined. Like we've got barcodes, we have to record the serial numbers. But I was just wondering if there's a way you could do something like a bash script or something, which basically you say, right, what model stack is it? What's this IP address? What's that IP address? And then you can paste the text into it, and then it basically just produces a text file, so you can just copy and paste it into the switch config.
Do the switches have? Do you know if they have an API that you can talk to?
No, I don't think there is. Kind of thing.
Okay.
So basically, it's just like you putty onto the switches by SSH. Well, you're actually going by the serial connection on the switches. When you got on the desk, because so you basically paste it into PuTTY kind of thing, and then it.
Yeah, because I think it's Ansible 2.1 that they put in a load of support for networking gear.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm just looking at the docs here. I've got A10, Acer, Citrix, Cumulus, Dell OS 10, 10.6.9, EOS, Exoscale, F5. Illumos, iOS, iOS XR, Junos, NetConf, NetVisor, NXOS, OpenSwitch, Panos, SROS, and VIOS.
Okay.
I assume that doesn't help you because you haven't said anything. So, but yeah, that will let you do like an Ansible playbook, which will then, you know, help you configure your switches.
Yeah.
I mean, I'd say the first thing to do is just like, copy all that config stuff into just an ASCII text file. So, like, use a Notepad++ or something.
Yeah,
that'll get you around the double quote problem.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'm not sure about scripting it really, because it's you can't sort of, because with SSH you can you can just fire a command at it.
Yeah,
so you could construct a command externally and then just fire that switch.
So I was wondering if you could basically just create the text file you need to paste into it, so you haven't got to go away about how I was going with the red text, you do this, the red, and make sure you go like that. You could say when you write this, so you could put the information in the script. So like a menu. So in the command prompt, you'd say, right, it would ask you a load of questions. And depending on what questions you answered, it goes, right, VLAN 10, what's the IP address? It goes, oh yeah, so I need to put that, I'll put that little bit of text in, and then it goes on to the next line kind of thing. So
yeah,
it produces a text file which you can then copy and paste directly into the terminal.
It sounds like something that probably Bash wouldn't be that great for, but one of the other sort of more powerful languages, like maybe Python or Ruby or whatever,
yeah,
will be better for, but I couldn't probably, personally, I haven't really sat down and learned enough of that yet to be able to think about how to do it. But it's a good idea. I mean, you definitely want to get it out of Word documents. But there's always that thing, isn't it, when you, do you spend the time automating it, or do you just do the donkey work? I mean, I would always say do the automation, because if you're just doing it by hand, there's much more scope to make a mistake there, and whereas if it's automated, once you know it's working, you can literally just put the values in
Have the likes of a router, say, and then you configure a router, and then you can go to export or back up my settings to some kind of local config file or something like that.
Yeah.
I know this is kind of after the event, right? But, you know, if you did one and configured it and then you exported those settings to a config file and then went to the second one and then imported the second settings to the second one, or if there's any way of editing that config file.
Yeah, well, that's what we're doing at the moment. So a guy, the network engineer, he's running the project, has said, right, this is a switch setup. This is how I want the config. He then exported it and then color-coded the bits he wanted to change, you see.
Okay, yeah.
And then I basically imported that into the thing. So I just want to think of a way, an easy way of not mucking that up kind of thing is by...
Yeah.
But no, again, it's that thing about chicken and egg thing, is that do you do it kind of like that, or if it's my project running, maybe kind of thing, but yeah, we'll see kind of thing. Anyway, that's what my first kind of thing is. Yeah, I could also go about going scripting is I want to mention about the Mike Tech show. He had his 600th episode and he was saying why he was scared about his about scripts. And a bit what I like about scripts is that you can do so much damage to him. He basically wrote a script which basically broke an email server. There's also data, kind of
the 24 hours. Yeah.
So that's why I was a bit scared of doing scripts. Is that I was, well, you have to test it, kind of thing. So, but with me, we're just at the moment with this thing, it doesn't really matter because we're putting the switches into, we're taking this network down, putting it in. We're not going to be affecting production, kind of thing.
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. It's like what they call a greenfield site, isn't it? Yeah. So. Yeah, you haven't got to worry about stuff that's in production that you're changing.
It's a test bench, isn't it? So if you completely screw it up, then you just press the reset to factory default button on the back of it and start
again. Get your
paperclip
ready.
Yeah.
And then I was going to say that also he had your Canon rock cover. You did the Canon cup rock cover, didn't you? Because he played his favourite tune at the end and then...
Oh, yeah, that's right, yeah. So he played the original, I suppose, if there is an original, but the classical version of Packer Bell's Canon in D, and it's one of those tunes everyone's heard, you know. I did a rock version, which also somebody called Jerry C did, about 15 years ago now, and so I sent it him on his Facebook page. And for him to look at. He said he liked it, so.
Good, we'll put links in the show notes to that as well. So.
Yeah, okay.
Good. So, what have you been up to then, Andy?
Okay, well, I've done a few things this week. I'll start with the easy one. Went out to one place. I've been there several times before. They rang me up in a bit of a panic. Like 6 o'clock, 7 o'clock one night, and said, "Can I come in at 8 o'clock in the morning?" I said, "Yeah, why?" I said, "Nothing is talking to anything," was the description that I got. So I thought, great, what could that be? So basically, nobody could access anything. So got the first thing the next morning, and it took me about... half an hour, actually. I was on one of the computers checking this, checking that. Wasn't getting IP addresses. It was just coming up as unidentified network, you know, on the Windows panel. I was thinking, right, something's not plugged in here or something's gone down. So I eventually traced it all back. And then I found that... they've got two rack switches that are linked together, and the second one, because we then found out that some people could communicate but most people couldn't. So what I ended up finding was the second one was basically had no flashing lights on the front of it. So if your switch has got no flashy lights on it, we all like flashy lights. You know, the more flashy lights we can get, the better. And so I thought, it's dead. That was the initial thought. So I've just checked all around the back. And then I found out, I just saw that the plug was kind of half in, half out. I don't know how on earth it's got like that. I don't know if something's been pulled or whether it's just worked loose over time. The four gang sockets were kind of vertical. So I don't know whether the weight of something's kind of half pulled it out. So it's literally just a case of pushing it back in again. And then everybody worked again. So it sounded like a big, massive, big, huge problem, but it was a really simple, simple little fix to it. But more importantly than that, I've been messing about with my little NAS that I made at home. And I did the thing I said I'd do in the last episode. So I got a little, PCI Express x1 gigabit network card for it. I didn't have to cut the bracket off. It came with the proper bracket that you could screw on. So I put that in there. So now I had the situation where on Ubuntu server, I just added a second network card. So I didn't really care about the original one. I just wanted to get the second one working. So I was trying several things, and then couldn't get it to work. But anyway, I had to leave that because I had to go off and do something else. So while I was away, I was kind of thinking about, why it wasn't working or what went wrong with it and that. So I thought, I've got an idea. I'll send both of you a message saying, this is what I've done, and can you figure out what I've gone wrong? So I thought, in the message, I wanted to get some screenshots to show you what I'd done. I got the NAS turned on, plugged it all in, went to get the screenshots, and then I realised that the whole thing was working. So I'd done something the day before, and I don't know what I did, but it got it working. But I think it may have been one of those situations where, you do something and it doesn't work until you reboot it or restart the service or whatever. So I must have done something like that. So I've put some of the things that are done into the show notes, just so if anyone wants to look at it, they can see what it did. So I went on to use PuTTY to get onto the server. This was initially anyway, and I wanted to see if there was a command for what would you call it? Like listing the network cards that are in the computer itself. So I used the netstat-i command. And then that listed what interfaces was on there. I then used the there's another command to use, which is IP link show. And that then displayed what I'm assuming is the two different network cards which were now in it. Now I was expecting an ETH0 and ETH1 for Ethernet 0, Ethernet 1. But I couldn't find any of them. But I found one called, and again, this is in the show notes, so I found one called ENP3S0, and I found another one called ENP0S7. Soon figured out that which one was which. So then I went to the, I used Vim to go on to the interfaces file. And then where it says in the interfaces file, the iface, inet static for the address, I changed that from the ENP0S7 to the ENP3S0. what it was trying to do was kind of tell it to change, to apply these settings to that network card and not the other one. That is all I did, and it wouldn't work. But I think once I'd left it, and then actually by the next day I was obviously then rebooted it, then it started to work. So was I on the right lines doing that kind of thing? I obviously was somewhere along the line because it did actually work.
Do you want to go ahead, Jerry, or do you want to, do you know?
So, oh no, you go for it. Oh, sorry.
Yeah, so tell me if I'm wrong. So you basically did an iSync and you got ENS30S0. And if I do that on my, if I do that on my machine on now, and I got an I get an EN2S0. Right. Because of the way this whole system D thing works, you might have heard me and Jerry talk about it before.
I was actually just looking up about that. That you know, you said you were expecting E0 and so on.
Yeah,
it's to do with
Yes, it's called System D. It's called predictable network interface naming. So I was just trying to, because I've talked about it in an earlier podcast, but I was just looking it back up again.
So there's all this way that Andy, they changed all the way the systems work. So in Ubuntu and something like, they changed all the way that used to be the init system, the way the system boots up and the way it. I don't really understand how it works, but not a lot of people like it or they don't like it. And that's why I like FreeBSD, because we haven't got systemd in FreeBSD. You've got the old init system, so you get the stop, start services command, and it's all working. So that's why you've got a thing. And you're right about the white thing. The thing you didn't do is when you remember it with Linux is that when you edit a text file, it doesn't automatically work. It's not like Windows where you change a setting and click apply.
Yeah.
What you did was you would need to stop and start the network stack, and then that would have worked. But because you shut the machine down and brought it up, you basically did that.
That restarted
that's why
it then.
It's working.
Yeah.
Is that right, Jerry? What you said?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So on Ubuntu, it'd probably be systemctl restart network, I think, or restart networking to get that going. But yeah, a reboot will also do it, but you don't necessarily always want to do a reboot.
Yeah.
Actually, I think on Ubuntu and Debian, you can still say etc init d networking restart, and it'll, because you know that I'm used to typing that to restart things, so I think on Debian it will honour that. It will honour that. So if you do, you can either do systemctl or etc init d.
Do you know what version of Ubuntu is, that latest version? Is that 16.04 or something you've running
pretty
there?
It's pretty recent, because I only did it, only loaded it a month or two ago, wasn't it? Something like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I've done some updates and applied and all that, you know.
But a quick Google will find the answer.
Yeah. Could be 16.10. Is it 16.10? Yeah.
Well, 16.10 will be the latest one, which is the... Not the long, the LTS would be 16.04.
Make sure you keep it updated. So when 17.04 comes out, make sure you upgrade it, because otherwise it won't be supported.
Okay. I did some updates last week. I did some updates after this got working. So
I think it should tell you when you log in that it's going end of life EOL. So.
Oh, it says here, welcome to Ubuntu 16.04.1 LTS.
So 16.04 will be supported, for, I think, for 4 years.
Yeah.
So just keep going with the updates.
So you get basically the numbers work out, is what I quite like, is that 16.04 means it's long an LTS, which means it's a fourth month, because they all release it in April and October. Mm. So you've got 16.04, so obviously 2016.04, and then... Dow does release 16.010, which is not a long term release. I don't know what they call it. I think there's a name for it, which is like, and it's basically got all the cutting edge things they've been working on between 16.010. So if you want to, you can upgrade your 16.04 to 16.10, but then 16.10, I think they only support it for 9 months. So you support it until the next one, and then you're meant to upgrade it and you get 3 months grace period. Whereas the 16.04 will be last, you get support for 4 years. 4 years time.
I've just had that an idiotic eureka moment where you just said that the 16 is a year. Yeah. Yeah, and that's why it was 14, I don't know, 2 years ago, possibly.
Yeah. I didn't realise that at the start until I did. But I think my first, what's your first version, can you remember, Jerry? I think I used 12.04, I think it was my first.
I didn't use Ubuntu, I was Fedora. Yeah. And then I went to, I don't know what I went to after that. I think I just went to Debian after that.
Yeah.
When did it start?
2004, apparently. The version, the code name was called Warty Warthog.
So there wasn't Warty one called War. Ubuntu 96 or anything?
No. I think I might have been at 2008, I tried it.
I think I remember having a netbook at the time, an HP Mini 9 or something, and someone said, oh, you want to try this Ubuntu on it, and it, I think it was when they first released Unity kind of thing. So I can remember the bar on the left-hand side with the things, and I didn't really get on with it kind of thing. But
It's not like FIFA, you know, the game FIFA. The numbering system's gone backwards on that because, I started on FIFA 95 and now it's on FIFA 16.
Yeah. But it's like my FreeBSD actually quite mean. It's like the current is 11. But the edition I had with running on my VPS runs, the Admin website was on 10.2, and they only support, again, they release 10 and then they do one release, 10.1, 10.2, 10.3. And I literally just upgraded from 10.2 to 10.3 about a month ago. Well, it must be since we did the last podcast, because what happened was it was a bit scary doing it because I hadn't done it before, but on the DigitalOcean, it tells you what you have to do. And you can do a brilliant thing on DigitalOcean as well, is that you can shut your droplet down, take a snapshot of it, and then you can power your droplet back up. And then from the snapshot, you can then deploy a droplet with the snapshot. So it's like a clone of your live production server. And it does it all the IP addressing for you. So it came up with a new IP address. So I had a clone of our working website. And I basically did a test upgrade in the background. And it all worked fine. So then I basically did it on the live. I could have basically just swung it across. But the only thing is that it wouldn't have my AWS stats logs on it. So I basically just took it down, upgraded it. And the only thing that broke was I didn't realise everything worked. Except when I went to upload the latest podcast, it wouldn't let me connect by SSH. It wouldn't let me connect by SFTP to upload the thing. It said it couldn't connect. Wouldn't have
looked. That's because the host keys have changed on the a new machine means new SSH host keys. So
no, it wasn't that. It's because I had the one, and it was that. Something had changed in the SSL or something, the open SSL, it didn't have the right version. So I basically, because I can, in FreeBSD, you've got these things called packages, which I talked about, where if people have written packages, they're like the, when you're doing Ubuntu, you can just go apt-get install Apache or whatever. But the thing is it VSFTP, a very secure FTP server? Yeah. That is in packages, that's in ports. So basically someone's gone along and basically downloaded all the files you needed so you can just do a make install, it does it for you. And I basically had to uninstall it and then reinstall it because I had to uncompile it and then recompile it again, and it compiled it with the right SSL libraries this time, and then the server started again. So
so you're using FTPS, right?
Yeah.
Okay.
Because I didn't want to get, because if you do an upgrade in WordPress, WordPress only does FTP or secure FTP kind of thing, not SSH. Yeah.
SFTP.
Yeah.
So SFTP is a kind of subset of SSH, so it uses the SSH system.
Yeah.
Whereas FTP is FTPS is FTP with kind of security stuff tacked onto
it. Because I basically locked it down, my SSH, to you, so you have to use keys. So if you do an upgrade using WordPress, you can do it, can't you? Where you can basically put the files in the right place. But if you do it through the web portal, part of the web thing, it does it all for you, kind of thing. So.
Yeah.
Cool. Okay. Anything else about your NAS server there, Andy? Or
No, but now it's been running great. Just, you know, copying stuff over to it is nice and quick. So it's been made up. I was going to say, another thing that I did as well, initially, I think you said it actually. I hooked it up to a keyboard and monitor, and I went into the BIOS to try and disable the onboard motherboard LAN connector. Of course, I did that, and then I couldn't connect to it at all then, obviously. So I had to put it back on again. So I think it's still enabled on the motherboard, but I really don't suppose it matters, really, does it?
No.
It's but I'm assuming you can run two network cards in this. I don't know what advantage I'd possibly get out of it, but can you run two network cards in the one server and use one for one thing and one for the other?
Yeah, or you could. Can you team it?
It depends on your switch, I think, or your network.
Yeah,
no, it's only basic.
I think you can do it without. Was it mode 6 bonding? You don't need the switch to be specially configured.
Yeah, we can think of a thing called switch. Well, I don't know what's in it. In Windows, you can get a thing called a switch independent mode. So the way you've got to remember, Andy, is that you're never going to get. If you've got two links, you've got 2 gig links. So one link, another link, and you've got 2 gig links, and you put them into a switch. Yeah. You can bond them, but you're never going to get greater than that 1 gig because you can't. Unless you, there's different ways you can do it, but like you got to think of it like if you could have it so that one, so you have one service or another. So if you've got two people connect to it and you got two people streaming video, you could have one IP, one piece stream going through one of them and then one going through the other kind of thing.
It's not going to double the speed, but it'll just double the bandwidth.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Depending, that's like, or you can do it, so you can do a trunk as well, so you can have them in one switch, and then it can talk it. So I don't know. With the Windows stuff and Windows 2012 above, it does it all for you. You can go into the settings and you can configure it, kind of thing. So mainly we do switch independent because we're normally using where you've got it so that each. Because we're normally doing it with like virtualization, you want to have you can basically say which VMs get which NICs kind of thing. So the NICs, because you can share the NICs about from the thing. So that's quite good. So Jerry, what have you been up to?
Not a lot really to report. I've been learning more about Apache because in my day job they use Apache a lot. So more about the configuration really. I can't recall any of it right now. You know, it's the weekend. I've been ill. My brain's not working particularly well. But I will get back to you on that in a future episode with a few nuggets there to do with Apache configuration. I mean, I've just used it for very basic web serving, PHP, configuring all that. But they're kind of using it in different ways at this place. So they've got basically a front end Apache server, which is kind of passing traffic back to apps and things like that. So a bit more advanced than what I've been doing just with the freelance stuff really. So I've been using Apache in my last day job, but two in the oil industry. There's barely any web stuff whatsoever, so it's kind of it's all a bit new to me. It's been doing about 4 years now, but it's learning stuff all the time anyway. So, and also kind of in that same vein, I had a bit of a a eureka moment with IP tables, which is the Linux inbuilt firewall. So yeah. I've kind of avoided it up until this point because, not working, companies that I've been working for haven't really, you know, the firewall has been at the edge of the network, and you've basically got this big WAN and you don't really have to worry about configuring IP tables, so I never have. So, but I had this one moment where I was trying to get, there was a firewall configured on this machine, and I needed to get MySQL to be able to talk between two servers. So, a web app on one server had to talk to MySQL on the second server, and it just wasn't working. I'd Googled how to do it. I put the rules in. As they were expected to be, and it didn't work. So I was thinking, well, how's that work then? Couldn't work it out. And tried to ask a mate, he didn't get back to me. So I was like, oh, I'm gonna have to work this out for myself then. And as it turned out, I sort of had this moment where I thought, if I put that rule above this other rule, in the kind of stack of rules, that might work. Mm. And it did. So basically how IP tables seems to work is that when a packet comes in, it goes through each different rule one by one. And it might have allow packets from anywhere to this interface.
Yeah.
And then the next rule down might say allow MySQL from this server to this server, which is my rule that I did. And then the last rule says reject everything else. So if this packet has made it all the way down to the bottom and it hasn't matched anything, then it gets rejected. And that's exactly what happened. I'd put my rule in underneath the reject line, so the packet wasn't being matched before it got rejected.
Yeah.
So I put this rule in above the reject line and it worked.
Yeah, that's how many firewalls work, with the thing where the last line is denial kind of thing. So if it gets to a line, it goes, all right, so the allow port 83, then the packet gets through. So then the next packet then goes to the top and it goes drop down again kind of thing.
Yeah.
I was going to say...
Sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, was it because MySQL was basically, because normally you configure MySQL to only listen to itself, doesn't it? Like on a local thing, isn't
it? Yeah, I mean, a lot of the servers I've dealt with in the past are single stack, as they're called. So they've got Apache, MySQL, PHP on the same machine.
Yeah.
I mean, it is possible to split all that out into different machines, which is kind of what we're doing in this case, because MySQL can chew up all the resources and make the actual web server slow.
Yeah.
So I often recommend that you kind of decouple them.
And for security as well, like you have it different.
Yeah. I mean, you can say in MySQL, you can say only allow this user from this IP address, but then...
Yeah, because that's what I'm going to say. Like normally, like on a, when you do it on a single stack, you basically say only listen on the local host kind of thing, so only... accept connections from internally, don't accept connections from external kind of thing. So
yeah, one other thing about allowing packets and so on with IP tables, you can have a default deny policy. So it's basically every packet gets rejected and or dropped or whatever unless you specifically allow it, which one of the servers I'm working on has that as well. So so kind of, you know, armed with this knowledge, I'm going to go out and configure IP tables on all my other clients' machines now. Hopefully not cut them off and not be able to get back to
them. I wonder if there's a safe rule. It's basically, because like on the microchips I've got, there's like a thing where it will know if you cut yourself off, you can basically have a safe mode. So if you cut, you can, if it doesn't... Yeah, I mean, I've got IP tables on most of my servers, and, well, I don't think what this called... Is it PF? Yeah, PF says. I think I'm running PF on my FreeBS box, which is basically there's a text file.
That's supposed to be a lot more versatile than IP tables, apparently.
Yeah.
PF. Yeah. Yeah, I might have to spin up a FreeBSD box.
Because that's another thing, actually. which going back to Andy's about how it restarts, I've actually emailed in to FreeSB, the BSD Now podcast, to see if they can work this out. Basically, I was doing some IP checking in my config by host name. So I've got a couple of things where I want to connect it remotely, but like by DNS host name. So like, you don't put like basically blah, 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 IP kind of thing, only if it connects. So your machine will do a reverse lookup of the IP address you're coming from. But the problem I had is that it worked fine when my machine was booted up. So I was doing my testing, starting the firewall rule, shut it down, try it for another place. Oh, yeah, that then stops. But what had happened is that when I rebooted my server next time, the firewall hadn't come up because it had an error in the IP tables. And the only way I knew it, because I could see people trying to attack my SSH on port 22. And what it is that when the server boots up, it boots up really quickly, and basically DNS hasn't, because basically what it does, it looks at the DNS. So basically you go, oh, IP tables, right, blah, 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 right, I'm going to basically DNS for a name resolution of that name and then put the IP into my thing. But because it's doing it too quickly, it was failing on that line. So if you when it server boot up and you go status of PF, it go no, not running. Start PF, worked. But again, look, logs using that whatever that thing you say, loggy, whatever it's called again. What's it called again? I've basically got my logs pushed into that
paper trail.
Yeah, paper trail. Look for it. Oh yeah. So I don't. So I basically just manually put the IP address in, took the DNS name out, and it worked. So.
Can you order the way the when the services start up?
Yeah, well, in FreeBSD there's a file called rf.config, I think it's called, and that's basically
rc.config.
Config, and that's where everything happens. So I thought, I know what, I'll put it at the bottom, but no, it didn't help. So
right.
I emailed the guys at the BSD Now podcast, see if they can come back to me about
I'm sure. I'm sure Alan Dew can help you.
Yeah, that's what I'm hoping.
He's a very knowledgeable man.
Yes. So, yeah, anyway, that's good. That's two of my things crossed off my list. Yeah. Good. Okay, anything else? We were mentioning quickly, I can't remember if we were in the last one about the recovery to RTO and RPO kind of thing. So I'll just quickly go over
that. This is to do with backups, wasn't it?
Backup and recovery plans. So you've got the recovery point object and the recovery time. I think the recovery point RPO we go first. So that's how much data you can lose. So if you're doing nightly backups, let's say, and you lose, so your backup feels like loses, you basically do a backup, like let's say, so we go along, it's Saturday, and we do a backup Saturday night, all the way during the day, and then at 12 o'clock, your server dies. And we basically have to restore from tape, or from your hard drive. The only way you can restore from is from last night backup. Can your business cope with losing that amount of data from last night, and from the load of the backup until today, if you see what I mean? And then the recovery time object is how long can your systems be down for your go out of business, basically. So if you're a call centre and you've got 100 people there kind of doing nothing while the system's down kind of thing, how much money can you cope with not being offline kind of thing? And the smaller the RTO and the smaller RPO is going to be more expensive, kind of, basically. So, is there anything else you wanted to go over? But you were talking about the YouTube to our computer file.
Oh, yeah.
Andy?
Yeah, I was watching something since the last time, actually during this week, on computer file. And it just made me sort of realise a few things and think about a few things in different ways. Now, one of the things he was talking about is how how memory works. Now, I've put some links to the YouTube videos of these specific videos on YouTube on the Computer File channel, where he probably describes it about a million times better than I'm going to describe it. But basically, the gist of it is so this one, how the memory works. Now, this goes back to when before I did computers for a living, and it was only just a hobby. I had an apprenticeship at a well-known nuclear facility. I don't actually know if it exists anymore, British Nuclear Fuels. I don't know if it's a company anymore or not. I'm not entirely sure, but I had an apprenticeship at BNFL, and in instrumentation, measurement, and control. So there's a lot about control systems, electronic control rather than computer control. In fact, funnily enough, it's most of that kind of work is computer controlled now. Whereas at the time, it was a bit more, it was more electronics / PLC controlled. Now, one of the things that we did learn a lot about was the logic gates that you can get in microchips. I don't know if you two have used these before. Well, I don't know about any of the listeners either, whether they've heard of NOR gates, OR gates, and NOT gates.
Yeah, so the truth tables and things like that.
That's right, yeah, truth tabling. Yeah. It's called Boolean algebra.
Takes you back to my electronics days when I did it at college.
Well, yeah, I mean, I'd done all of this, but never really thought about NOT gates and OR gates as being memory in terms of computers that we think of today. So how it basically described it was, well, first of all, the difference between these gates, they're basically called logic gates. So if we take an AND gate, so an AND gate would, say, have two inputs. I know some of them have three or four or more inputs, but just keep it simple. Just an AND gate has two inputs. And it basically has to have, well, they used what was called TTL, which is transistor logic, which was 5 volts on, 0 volts off. But just like binary, it's on or it's off. So an AND gate would be, you would have to have an input on one and the other to get an output from the chip. And then you could use that output to switch something else on. An OR gate would have to have an input from one or the other in order to get an output. And a NOT gate would basically invert the signal. So if it was, if you had 5 volts or a 1 signal going in, it would have a 0 signal going out. And if it was a 0 signal going in, it'd have a 1 signal going out. You could also combine these into the NOT gate, into the OR and the AND gates, and they were called NAND and NOR gates. So they'd basically make an AND gate work backwards. So 2 inputs to an AND gate would result in no output, and no inputs would result in an output. Now, what they actually did on the computer file is they actually set up a little very simple memory circuit using some of these chips, some of these gates. And I think the chip that he used was a 4001 chip, 4002 chip. You can buy them quite readily now. They're only pennies to buy. So what he used was 2 NOR gates. So this is a NOT and an OR gate combined. And then what he did was he took the output from NOR gate, call them A and B because there's 2 of them, the output from NOR gate B into one of the inputs of NOR gate A, and he took the output of NOR gate A to one of the inputs of NOR gate B. Now, the other inputs on each of the chips, he tied them down to 0 volts with a resistor just for this demonstration. And then what he did is he applied a 5-volt input to one of the other inputs on each NOR gate. And he basically touched one of the inputs with 5 volts on one. And he connected an LED to the output so you could see a light coming on. So he connected, he touched a 5-volt signal onto one of the inputs and one of the LEDs came on. And then, of course, he let go of the, he took the cable off and the light stayed on. He then applied the input to the second chip, second input, and then the second LED light came on. So what he'd basically done there was made a very, very simple memory circuit. I would describe that as storing, because you touched the signal on and the light stayed on, so it remembered the input. So I would say that as basically storing one byte of information. And then when he touched it onto the other one, the other light came on. It remembered that input and kept that light on. So basically all the memory that we use now, all the little SIMs and DIMMs and all that kind of stuff that we use now, is probably several million or several, I don't know how many, of these little NOR gates that he used in that demonstration. Obviously there's 8 of those little circuits would make a byte. And then this particular chip I've got in my hand, if people are watching, you can see it, is a 2 gigabyte chip. So that has, how many would that be? 2 billion.
2 billion. Basically.
Yeah, 2 billion of these NOR gates that he made. So I thought that, and that sort of like just hit a sort of point with me of realizing, oh God, yeah, that's what they are, effectively. Mm-hmm. You know, because I think that nowadays they're a bit more complicated than just sticking, remembering things on an OR gate, because they have all kind of address protocols and IRQs and address numbers and stuff like that.
Well, I think at the lowest level, that's all they are, because all they're doing is storing digital information, isn't it? So
yeah.
It's just that they're retrieving the information and storing it at, a fraction of a second, a fraction of a millisecond.
Yeah, so I suppose at the very, very basic level, they're all NOR gates, 2 billion NOR gates all connected together, to save bytes and bytes and bytes of information,
And it's the same with we go about the exclusive war the other day about how it does with the raid and how it rebuilds a raid after it's...
Yeah, I was going to mention that. So it's using this logic to rebuild, data on a disk, using parity and all that kind of thing.
Huh. Yeah, so that's one thing I watched. It sort of struck a nerve, not struck a nerve, but it just sort of made me realise a different way of looking at memory that I hadn't really thought of in the past. Now, I did move on another video, which I found quite interesting. And what he did is he went back to remember the old BBC Micro from quite a long time ago.
Chucky Egg.
Yeah. Probably.
I was more of a Spectrum guy myself.
Okay. I had Amstrads, but the I remember the school having. I think every school in the country had a BBC Micro, didn't they?
Yeah, with Chucky Egg on it.
So. What this is kind of interesting, you look at it in a different way. The BBC Micro had RAM chips that ran at twice the speed of the CPU. And you may think, well, what's so interesting about that? And he mentioned that the memory in the BBC Micro ran at 4 megahertz, but the CPU ran at 2 megahertz. Which, I know that's not very good compared to nowadays, but that's what they were at the time. So basically, the CPU would send its request to RAM, and the RAM could return the information really quite quickly, while the CPU could send the data out to the video chips to form the display. So because the memory was twice the speed as the CPU, it could multiplex quite efficiently compared to other systems at the time, and not slow the system down. Now, you may think that's, you know, not particularly interesting or relevant, but if you look at it now, you know, nowadays it's the opposite way around, because now the CPUs are far faster in terms of access speed than the chips are. Now, this one I've got in my hand here is PC3 1060. So there's that 1.06 gigahertz chip.
Yeah, I think so.
Right. But that could go in a machine that has a 3 gigahertz processor. So nowadays, your processors are far faster than the RAM that you put into them. Several magnitudes faster. Whereas back then, in the BBC Micro, the RAM was twice as quick as the chip was. So it's an interesting point. Why is that the fact, you know, now? Why has CPUs gone faster and RAM not gone faster? So, but that does bring into something else of how to get around the problem. So I forgot what to say next. Hang on. So over time, if they'd have kept it like that, an increase in CPU speed would not benefit the system, because it would still have to wait for the slower memory to catch up. So in order to get around that, we now use a cache in the CPU. So when you look at CPUs, and they only have a very small sort of cache in them, don't they? But you buy a chip and it has something like 8 megabytes of cache, is it, or something like that. Now, for people who don't know what a cache is in sort of old English terms, he described it as like, it's a little storage place, isn't it? It's a place that you'd store your food for winter. It's a place that pirates would keep the treasure. You know, it's a cache. It's a little storage facility of something. But I found it quite... So that's how they kind of get around it. They use this cache in the CPU to kind of load in, you know, load in things that it does very regular. You know, instead of going out to the RAM in order to do it, it keeps it all inside the chip. Now, that cache memory in the chip is very small compared to the gigabyte DIMMs that we get now. But apparently it's down to cost. And that memory in modern day CPUs is very small, but it's very fast.
I can remember when you had to buy caches separately.
Right,
there's like a little, tiny little. It's like almost like a laptop DIMM, so DIMM thing, that sort of size, and it would sit right next to the CPU.
Okay. You know? So obviously at some point in the sort of evolution of computers, back then the RAM chips were faster than the CPU. So at some point they've kind of equaled out, and then the CPUs have gone faster, haven't they? But then in order to compensate for that, that's why these CPUs have now got caches in them, to compensate for the slower RAM speed. And I guess I'd never really thought about it like that before, but you know, when you look at a DIMM chip, I don't know what they run at nowadays. I know that they're a bit quicker than they're a lot quicker than they used to be, aren't they? This is a 1.06 gigabyte one I've got in my hand now. They used to have 333 megahertz ones, didn't they? I don't know how fast PC. How do you know that off the top of your head? How fast does PC for RAM run at?
What, DDR4?
DDR4, I mean, yeah.
No.
I'll just have a look. Roughly see how they run at. 2.1 is one that's come up. Oh, hang on. Yeah, one that's come up on here is 2.1 gigahertz. But even so, I mean, you could put that in a machine that's got a 3 gigahertz processor, couldn't you? So I was watching some of those videos, and they go on. There's a load of other videos on Computerphile, if anyone's not seen them. They're really interesting. We're talking just before the show about...
Yeah, you can kind of get into a bit of a black hole watching video after video.
And we're talking just before the show about the one about password hashing and stuff like that, which is actually quite scary, really. And as he puts it, right at the beginning of the video, he says, right, let's put it out there. Everyone's password is rubbish. Right. Mm-hmm. You know, your password's rubbish. Mm-hmm. Go away and change them. You know.
Yeah. That actually made, I think I know the one you're talking about, actually made me go and change my password, or the one, my LastPass password.
Yeah.
Which is, because I've got all random passwords, but my LastPass password was rubbish. So I changed it. It's quite interesting about what you were saying about there's an XKCD comic that says about, you know, if you use like four normal words, then you've got a better chance of having a strong password than using, you know, some kind of, like maybe a word that you're familiar with, mm-hmm. with the O's changed to zeros or whatever. So just use four English words together, and that's going to be a much stronger password. And you can change some of those to ones or zeros or whatever.
Yeah, but the words that don't, you know, go together in a normal sentence, aren't they, really?
Yeah.
You know, what did he use? Something like horse, staple, rabbit, cow, or something, you know.
Yeah.
It's not like a statement that you would commonly come out with in a sentence, is it?
Damn, you just guessed my password.
Yeah. I'm a genius. But now we've mentioned that password, it's now no longer a secure password anymore. So so you have to come up with with your own one.
The chances of a computer guessing those four words together is quite low. So the main thing about the passwords are vulnerable to is brute force. So just throwing words, any word at it and see if it unlocks the thing. So, but if you've got four words, then it's got a very low chance, apparently. The XKCD comic explains it a lot better, so I'll put a link in the show notes to that.
Good. Well, we had an email in, didn't we? I remember we had an email in, didn't we?
Oh, we did, thing. Yeah, we'll have to find... Have we got the email up? Oh, God.
I'll put it into the show notes.
Okay. Yeah, it came through last week, wasn't it? Something like that. Yeah, there we go. Right. It's from Andy. It's not from me. It's from somebody else, isn't it? Right. So he says, just started listening to the podcast this week. I heard it referenced on another show, but I'm not sure which one. Looking at the content, loving the content, was hoping to get shows from number one to the present via my podcatcher, which is Pocket Casts. But it only goes back to show 38. This is obviously done after show 48 came out. So it looks like the RSS feed only carries 10 episodes. Is this the correct behaviour? If so, I'll have to listen via the web or download outside Pocket Cast. Keep up the board work, Andy. Yeah, we've had this before, haven't we? Or we've mentioned it before.
I've kind of done a bit more research into what it is and what it, and how to fix it. It's basically the RSS feed we're using from FeedBurner basically pulls its feed from WordPress, and WordPress only by default displays 10 items at once. You can modify that, but it will mean that all pages will have more. So if you go to AdMan Podcast, it will show you 10 things. You can modify it by saying add might 12 or 14 or whatever, but that means that whenever someone visits the website, it will display 14 posts. And if I put that to 100 or whatever, it will mean that the page will take forever to load because it's got to load up 50 posts. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
And I need to kind of work out if there's a way to basically certain categories could have 100. So I may be able to make like 100 RSS feed, which is like podcast 100 or something, which basically lists all the podcasts, but only on that one. Because basically the idea is that you say, when I publish it, I say this is in a category of podcast feed and you tick the box. Uh-huh. So I'm wondering if I could have a second one that says podcast feed 2, which is going to have 100. You can have more than 10 kind of thing. So I need to look into that when I get a spare moment. And but also I just sent a link where you can download them more manually kind of thing. So
And I also replied saying about in Pocket Cast you can just play custom episodes, so you can upload the files to your device manually and then listen to them still in Pocket Cast, just in the custom episodes.
Is that what you use, Jerry, to listen to podcasts? Or
I use it to listen to our pre-release podcast before we put it out. I listen to it there.
Cool.
I have to check on, man. I use Podcast Addict.
Yeah.
So when I use, but I haven't checked on that, to be honest.
Because then you get all the advantages of a podcatcher where you can, it's got a widget on the screen and, all the volume stuff and all that kind of thing that you get with a podcatcher that you don't get with like a music player.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, because I've changed it now, so there's 11 to see if it works, and it has actually, there's 11 on the podcast list now, there's 11. Kind of thing, so I just need to work out how to only change it on one feed kind of thing. Alright, okay, well we're done the hour, I think, but we have got next episode will be the episode 50, woohoo, so we've got to do a bit of a special. That's our Christmas special this year, as we normally do. We will be recording it live. We will live on Sunday the 11th of December 9 p.m. Would that would be British summertime. That would be GMT.
UTC. UTC as well.
ETC, because
UTC. Zulu time, as they call it.
Zulu, yeah.
If you'd like us to chat about something or got ideas of what topics we should have it, any idea of what topic we could do, let us know. If not, we'd do about what podcast we've changed listening to in the last year kind of thing. So, yes.
So if you come along about that time, or maybe slightly after 9 o'clock on that particular day.
We never stop exactly at 9, do we?
Well, no. We'll have to post, don't know if we can post like a link on the Facebook pages, etc. Post. Okay. Yeah, cool. That sounds good. So,
any suggestions, go to mail at admin@podcast.co.uk or tweet at us or go to our Facebook page. Yeah.
We may even get some live requests coming through on the day.
You never know.
We do requests, within reason.
Good. All right then, guys. Good chat as always, and we'll speak to you all soon.
Yeah, see you next time.
Bye.